This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today we're talking about lead poisoning and a number of projects led by experts, researchers, and citizens to identify lead pollution before it has an impact on people. We're joined now by Alex John, Assistant Research Scientist at the Environmental Resilience Institute and Midwest Center for Birds and Biodiversity at Indiana University. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much.
So we're talking about lead poisoning today, Alex, and different ways people are working to study it in Indiana. How did you get involved initially?
Well, we began studying American robins a couple of years ago to try to get a handle on their role in dispersing zoonotic diseases such as West Nile virus. And a study was recently conducted by Eastern Michigan University in Flint, Michigan, which we all know has a lot of lead poisoning issues. And it inspired us to maybe replicate that here in Indiana. So what they found in Flint was that American robins, these common backyard birds, you know, that are in cities and towns and countrysides, in Flint, Michigan, they have much higher levels of lead in their blood than they do outside of Flint. So suggesting that they could be serving as a good indicator or sentinel of lead poisoning in the soil. So what we're doing now here in Indiana is basically using that same model to understand the lead contamination through robins.
How does the lead show up in the birds?
Well, we think that it's going to be mainly because they're eating so many worms in the spring and summer. So you know, a lot of your listeners probably have seen worms pulling those worms, you know, seen robins pulling worms out of the soil, especially in the spring when it's raining a lot. So, you know, worms eat soil and they're uptaking this lead with the soil. It gets bioaccumulated in the worms because they can't expel it. And then these lead contaminated worms will be eaten by the robins themselves, accumulating the lead over their lifetimes. And eventually, once we catch them, when we collect their blood, we can measure that.
Is there a reason why you're measuring it from robins versus the worms?
Well, we are doing the worms as well. You're going to be speaking in a little bit, I think, with John, who's one of the lead researchers on the worm side. But what we think is going to be beneficial in terms of understanding the role of birds, specifically robins, is that this process of bioaccumulation or the concentration of lead as it moves up the food chain will give us a much better handle on, you know, a more sensitive measure of the amount of lead out there. And also because robins move a lot more than worms, of course, you know, flying, migrating, they're going to capture a broader kind of signature of that lead out there in the environment.
I'm curious, just as I hear this, could a robin spread its lead poisoning to its offspring?
Absolutely. I don't know if it's been very well studied in birds, but I know in humans, when a woman becomes pregnant and she's been exposed to lead in the past, that lead, we know it goes into tissues such as our brain and liver, but it also gets stored in your bone. And women who are pregnant could be drawing calcium from the bone for the fetus, and therefore poisoning the fetus. You know, does that happen in birds? I don't think it's outlandish to think so. It could be something to study down the road.
How does lead stick around for so long as it moves up the food chain?
Well, it's a heavy metal, and because of that, we just can't expel it from our bodies, and birds can't either. So as that bird throughout its lifetime, so we're not sure how long a robin can live. It could probably live as long as 10, 15 years. So throughout that entire lifetime, if it continues to eat worms on a regular basis in places that are contaminated with lead, that lead isn't going out of its body. It's being stored in all these tissues, which we hope to capture, you know, that signature when we collect its blood. And for that matter, you know, we know that a lot of hawks, for example, eat robins. So the robins aren't the top of the food chain. And so this lead could be going all the way up to the predators of robins themselves.
What specific information have you been able to get from these birds related to lead pollution?
Well, we're just beginning. So this is the first year of the project. We are currently getting the blood samples ready for analysis, so we don't have any data yet. But what we're doing basically is to analyze the blood from the same birds that we track throughout their lives. So what we do is we put little GPS backpacks, we call them, on the backs of the robins. And those GPS devices, miniature GPSs, just like the ones in your smartphone, are tracking the position of that robin throughout the year. And so by combining that GPS tracking data with the blood from those same robins, we'll be able to understand where they picked up that lead.
I know you said that you're just starting this project this year. Is there anything you've found so far that with this GPS data that's been interesting?
Absolutely. So we understand now that Indiana robins primarily spend the winter in the Gulf states, so anywhere between Florida and Texas. A lot of them are migrating south right now, actually. They head down in October, November. It takes them about a month to get there, and then they move a lot throughout the winter in those southern states before heading back really quickly. It only takes them about a week to get back to Indiana. They might migrate back mainly in March. So that movement throughout winter in the southern states, I mean, in theory, we could also capture their exposure to lead at that larger continental scale, which will be very interesting, I think.
Well, I want to thank you, Alex, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to hear all of this information, and we look forward to seeing what else you find out. Alex John is an assistant research scientist at the Environmental Resilience Institute and Midwest Center for Birds and Biodiversity at Indiana University. Now to talk about another project around lead pollution in Indiana, we're joined by John Schuchel, a graduate student at IUPUI. Welcome.
Hi, Miriam. It's good to be here.
John, you're part of a project called Bookworms. Can you tell us what is behind this and what is the goal?
Yeah, I started Bookworms about a year and a half ago now as a side project in my doctoral work. And it was initially started because I was asked to map soil and dust heavy metal contamination globally as part of our Map My Environment project at IUPUI. And one thing that became obvious immediately was that while we have decent soil lead data and other heavy metal data in Indianapolis, most of the communities, surrounding communities in Indiana, and even in many neighborhoods within Indianapolis itself, we lack sufficient data to do a good job of mapping where there is lead, where there is not lead in the soil. And so what we wanted was a way for the community in urban Indianapolis and other urban environments across Indiana to get involved directly in this research. And we came up with a youth community science project that allowed Indiana youth to get directly involved with real science in about their own backyards and their own neighborhoods by collecting soil samples for us, and then also pairing those with worm samples. And as Alex already pointed out, worms are fantastic at bioaccumulating heavy metals in the soil environment. So this gives us information both about, at a fine scale, neighborhood level scale, where there's problems with lead contamination in urban and rural environments, and how that lead is mobilizing from the soil into the biosphere. And then what we plan to do and what we are doing is that to motivate community youth to get involved, for every kit that they complete and send back to us, we will provide them with a voucher for a free book, hence the Bookworms project.
Oh, that's really cool. And so the kits that you send out, what are those like?
Oh, they're very simple. Yeah, so we wanted to keep them as simple as possible. It's just a paper lunch sack. Inside are several Ziploc bags that are color coordinated to allow them to collect soil from specific areas of their homes or neighborhoods. If they want to collect at their homes, we ask them to collect near the drip line of their home, in the middle of their yard, and by their street. And that's just because lead pollution in soils around, urban environments is typically related to either lead paint on the home or historic use of lead in gasoline. And so we see gradients that come off of the roads with high lead near it and lower in the middle of the yard. And we see gradients that come off of the homes when they've had lead paint on them in the past.
Why did you decide to have kids be the citizen scientists for this?
That's a great question. Well, one reason is we wanted to empower the youth in the communities themselves to get involved and explore their own environment. The other is that lead is this really nefarious neurotoxin. And it can cause really permanent lifelong brain damage in youth. But one of the ways that's been shown that, you know, to combat that is by developing new neural pathways, and reading is a fantastic way to do that. So we wanted to, you know, partner with community youth to have them collect samples for us, but we wanted to be part of a solution for that by giving back to them, both by, you know, spreading books through the community and supporting youth literacy.
How can folks get involved who are tuning in right now?
Yeah, another really good question. So right now, we're partnering mainly with schools across Indianapolis, and then starting next semester statewide. But we also have a number of events that we're doing where people from the community can just come and get involved. We had one at IU Bloomington, their Science Fest, a few weeks ago. I mean, that was a really good success. We passed out close to 500 bookworm kits there. We're having another event at the Children's Museum on November 4th. That's part of their First Thursdays event. We will be passing out kits there for free. So please stop on by and you can pick up a kit then. And then if you want your school to be involved, you can send us an email at mapmyenvironment@gmail.org, and we can get your classroom or your whole school involved.
Before we wrap up, what are you hoping this project continues doing years from now?
Yeah. So one of the great benefits of this project so far is that we've been able to partner with Barnes & Noble directly to help provide the free books. And that partnership has been both like incredibly eye-opening and a big door opener for us. Barnes & Noble is very enthusiastic about the project and would like to take it to a much larger scale. So we hope that in next semester we will be taking it across most of Indiana, but beyond to multiple states.
Well, thank you so much, John. We really appreciate having you on the program, and good luck with everything.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
John Schuchel is a graduate student at IUPUI. After a quick break, we'll talk with more guests about lead poisoning in Indiana and efforts from experts and researchers to help people identify lead pollution in and around their homes. If you want to get in touch with us, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. With us now is Gabriel Filippelli, Chancellor's Professor of Earth Sciences and Director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI. Welcome to the program, Gabriel.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with looking at lead pollution in Indiana. How bad is it?
It's typical of a lot of Midwestern cities, to tell you the truth. After using lead for about 100 years or so, you know, in gasoline and in paint and in manufacturing processes, it's largely scattered around the city of Indianapolis. And it's scattered particularly where the city's a little bit older, right? Because about 50 years ago, we started weaning ourselves off of lead. But that doesn't mean the lead goes away. It's still all out there. And so we rank up there with the Flint, Michigans, the Columbus, Ohio's, and other older cities in the Midwest and East Coast.
You mentioned some gasoline and paint and stuff that has led to lead pollution, no pun intended there. Is there anything else that has caused lead pollution?
Yeah, there's always the potential that it's also can come from our water pipes, right? That was a Flint, Michigan example where old infrastructure usually includes lead service lines. So the water service lines, both in the city streets as well as sometimes into homes. And that they ran into trouble because they didn't anticipate or calculate very well how small changes in water chemistry can end up basically dissolving the protective layer inside those lead pipes and then flushing it into taps and then eventually into kids, unfortunately. So we in Indianapolis have the same array of lead service lines in the city. The problem is we don't know where they are because they weren't necessarily mapped. We have an idea based on the age of the neighborhood, you know, but we don't know exactly where they are. And for right now, we don't know the level of concern we should have with lead service lines. I think that our water company has been much more careful with how they manage their water chemistry. But, you know, that's certainly something we're looking into right now.
So are there areas in the state or communities that we know why we can't find out this information about their lead exposure levels?
Yeah, so it's for a couple of reasons. I'll start with the water. The lead service lines issue is that we only really started mapping the distribution of some of these things starting after we'd already phased out lead pipes with the Clean Water Act, and that was in the 1970s. So that's one of the reasons why we don't really know super clearly the distribution of those in water systems. But the other is in terms of, for example, paint or lead from old gasoline or industrial emissions, it's simply that we don't test soils or dusts inside homes very well or much at all. And so there's a lot of, you know, when we go out and do a lot of our testing, we find that there's a lot of elevated samples for both lead in soils outside your own home and in dust, but it's not super consistent. So we can go to one home and it's super high, and literally two houses over, it's normal, or at least not super high, if you know what I mean. So mm-hmm. although I can generalize for you that there's sort of a dome of higher lead exposure in Indianapolis that goes to the, you know, near north side, near south side, near east side, near west side. Once you get into really granular detail, you have to actually do the testing. And that's just not simply done very much in Indianapolis or any city.
Is it costly to do the testing? Is that why it's not so common?
It is. If you do it, like if you have the EPA or the county health department come in, there is a cost to it for sure. And that's what our big effort is let's remove the cost barrier and provide testing around the city as well as around the country, frankly, on a lot of the media, not the news media, the materials, the soil and dust and water that we're most concerned about.
What can people do to minimize their exposure if there's lead pollution nearby?
First is to test. Like I said, the conundrum with lead is that it's highly heterogeneous. So it's really spotty in terms of the elevated levels. So the first order is just to see if you have a risk, right? If you have no risk, then you don't have to do anything about it. But I usually, and I'm going to talk about like sort of the lens of an urban gardener, right? I've always been concerned a little bit by the fact that a lot of soils in the city have amounts of lead elevated above the safety standard. And so when you're mucking about in that soil gardening, you know, you're getting a lot of exposure that way. And potentially some of it can also transfer into the foods that you're growing. So what we started this whole effort on was providing free soil testing for urban gardeners as a way to identify whether there's a concern. And if we do find elevated levels, there's very simple ways to deal with that. And a lot of more experienced gardeners do this in any way, sort of naturally, like they add a lot of compost and they might do raised bed plantings, both of which dilute the lead or actually eliminate it altogether in their planting plots. So they end up growing things very safely. And I've done this testing for a range of community and small gardens and small farms in Indianapolis. And in general, the levels are pretty good. Except I have found a couple community gardens where they're quite high. And so that's where we advise kind of simple mitigation strategies.
Is there any kind of resource for folks to be able to see where lead pollution is that is known?
Yes, there is. And you can see generalized maps of where you might have the larger risks of concerns with lead exposure. We actually host a site for lead information. And this is important because this is, you know, the lead poisoning prevention week. And so we're trying to highlight the fact that there are resources. So this interactive map that we have shows all of the samples that we have to date on soil and dust lead in Indianapolis. And we host that at www.mapmyenvironment.com.
All right. I'm writing this down.
Thanks.
You know, when it comes to lead and the dangers of it, what can you give us insight into why people should be concerned?
Yeah, certainly. And I'll use a recent example just because it shows how lead remains a present, clear and present danger to children right now. And that's the Flint, Michigan example. Okay, so you had a system of a very bungled and actually corrupt water transformation system up there. They use water from one source that they had to pay money for. And they thought, well, we want to develop another source. So as an interim, we'll just take it right out of our Flint River right next door while we go ahead and develop that cheaper source without anticipating the corrosive chemistry of that water and the fact that it stripped basically a ton of the lead out of water systems. And as I mentioned, into children. And I think that the issue there is seeing now these children who were exposed about 6 years ago, 7 years ago, now they're in the school system. And before, where Flint children had something like 15% of them needed special services, special adaptive services, right? Learning, because they had learning difficulties. That number has raised to over 50% of those children. So as those children age and go into the school system, they are already having issues, right? They're having behavioral issues and they're having intellectual impairments, not because they were inherently bad kids. It was they were lead poisoned. And I think that's a clear example of watching a cohort of lead poisoned kids then getting into elementary school. And imagine those same kids, right, looking for futures. They're less likely to be eligible to go to college. And they're more likely to commit violent behavior because a lot of their risk impairment filters in their brains have been turned off by lead poisoning. So it just becomes a pernicious and ongoing issue for these poor children who are exposed through no fault of their own, and it's going to be with them for life.
Is it fair to say that a lot of the lead poisoning or even high contaminant areas of lead are in lower socioeconomic parts of town?
It's a fair statement, yeah. It's not always the case, but here's where there's an interesting sort of socioeconomic filter. So yes, lead is like a lot of environmental justice or a lot of environmental racist issues. It tends to be highest in lower income communities of color. And the presence of lead, right? The presence of lead in soils. I mentioned that, you know, lead-based paint was heavily used. Well, a lot of that lead-based paint is now degraded and into soils around the homes and sometimes in the dust inside the homes. These communities also are older, so they likely were present when there's leaded gasoline being burned, right? Which like blankets entire communities. And so they have a lot of these environmental burdens, and they tend then to reflect very high exposure rates for lead, right? These kids do tend to have higher blood lead levels, but there are some older communities with those same characteristics I just described, right? They're older, they had lead paint and all that. Yet the children don't exhibit a lot of lead in their blood. And that's largely because of a number of factors. One is they tend to be higher income neighborhoods. So those that, for example, they have a high home ownership percentage, and the homes are usually very well maintained. So there's not chipping paint inside or out. The soil is not just bare soil that the kids are playing in, but it's often, you know, landscaped or mulched. All of these are kind of unconsciously protective, lead protective practices. And furthermore, those children are very likely to have more access to pediatric health and healthcare, I'm sorry, as well as better nutrition. So strangely, by the coincidence of class and wealth, people can live in sort of lead-saturated areas, yet still feel none of the effects.
Wow, that's interesting. And when it comes to things being done, is the federal government doing anything to address lead poisoning, at least here in Indiana?
In my opinion, and in fact, they have largely given up. And they didn't give up because the problem was too difficult. They gave up because they considered the problem solved. So lead is one of these things that a lot of people used to be lead poisoned, grew up lead poisoned. And because of very stringent controls on the use of lead in gasoline, particularly, and maybe to a lesser extent in paint, the number of children who are lead poisoned in the U.S. is now hovering around 1% or slightly below 1%. Now, that number is still shocking to any public health expert. 1% is still an epidemic, right? 1% of all youth. But what's happened is that the distribution of those who are lead poisoned has changed, so that it used to be the general population, And now those like black and brown children of lower economic status, they are disproportionately elevated in terms of the blood lead levels compared to white children of higher economic status. So what happened is in one of these periodic reviews of funding that they give to various programs, the lead programs were largely defunded about 8 years ago, 9 years ago, leaving states with very little in the way of federal, pass-through resources to deal with it. So my answer is, I think the federal government has not prioritized lead enough, or has not maintained its priority for lead testing or lead mitigation. And as a consequence, here we are, you've got this problem that's out here in the communities and very few resources to deal with it.
I think what's interesting is when the story about Flint came out, it seemed like all of a sudden a lot of different communities, states, cities were looking into their water and their pipes, and there was a lot of talk. And now it just seems like we're not hearing anything anymore.
Yeah, the memory is short, isn't it? And the problem is those pipes are still all out there, certainly not in Flint. Flint's doing the right thing. They're replacing all of its lead service lines. And in the infrastructure bill that's going winding its slow way through Congress right now, there was, at least at last time I saw it, about $140 billion of that were dedicated to replacing lead service lines around the country. And so there's still some move afoot to deal with the water issue. But yeah, it's out of the headlines. While right now, I'll give you two examples why it shouldn't be out of the headlines. Newark, New Jersey is dealing with a terrible lead water problem. There were two studies even right here in Indiana, I think spawned by this concern from Flint of lead in water in public schools. There's a statewide survey and then a special focus survey on Indianapolis public schools. And they found, in my mind, a shocking number of water taps in schools that were above safety thresholds. In a couple cases, 100 times above safety thresholds. And this is in schools, right, where kids are supposed to be getting smarter, not being attacked by something that strongly affects their neurological development.
That's scary to think that, kids are going to school and that's where the harm is.
It is indeed. And to be clear, I don't think that school-based lead risks, like lead risks in schools, tend to have as strong an impact on children, because lead has a funny age arc to it. It's really young children, so from newborns through toddler stage, where you tend to find the highest lead in kids' blood. By the time they're in school, their ability to take in lead is reduced substantially. So at least, I don't consider school-age populations the most vulnerable, but it doesn't hurt if they've already been previously lead dosed at home that then they are continuing to be so at schools. And regardless, it's not good to have schools being environmentally unsafe environments.
Well, what do you think is next? Are you seeing any changes in things in the years that you've been working on this, or has it come to a stop? I know you mentioned earlier that first everybody was super involved and then they thought it was solved.
Yeah. So I think that there's a group of people, like-minded people like us, researchers who don't want to just do research in public publish papers that no one reads, but researchers who want to engage with communities to solve problems. There's a growing number of us who see lead as something that we can bring our research abilities to the problem, but that communities can help actually and create their own solutions. So I feel there's a lot of momentum on this. And in fact, we've had a very easy go at spinning up four different lead projects that we have in our lab, including one specifically on dust, including one on dust, soil, water, and paint, actually two separate programs. And so I feel there is some positive momentum, at least locally, and we're really working to maintain and expand that momentum. Because, again, it's a problem that's not going to go away by itself. Most experts, if you calculate it, it'll largely be gone in about 1,000 years because lead will have diluted into the environment. That 100 years of lead that we used from 80 to 1980, that'll be largely diluted. But, you know, 1,000 years is a long time, and we don't, you know, there's kids being poisoned now. And so I do see some interest. I even see some interest at the state level. The State Department of Health is, you know, working hard to try to implement a lower standard for lead across the state and piloting that as a way to help us provide services to kids when they actually need it. I think the problem is that we used to think that the problem exhibited only in kids with very high levels of lead, but as the science is getting better and better, we realize that there's no amount of lead that's safe. And in fact, you can probably get strong impacts at what used to be considered low levels. And so that's where a lot of our focus is happening right now. And a lot of our efforts are just to provide resources that communities can use to detect where there is lead, if there is any, and to simply fix it.
This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing lead poisoning and ongoing efforts from experts at universities in Indiana to help families test for lead pollution in their homes. We're joined now by Heidi Beidinger, director of the Master of Science in Global Health Program at the University of Notre Dame and co-founder of the Notre Dame Lead Innovation Team. Welcome to the program, Heidi.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Can you explain what this project is that you're working on and what the goal is overall?
Yeah. So the overall purpose of this grant is ultimately to prevent lead poisoning from happening in the first place. And the way that we want to do that is that we want to be able to help families to identify lead hazards in their home before anybody is exposed or hurt by lead poisoning.
How would somebody identify it before they're exposed? Is there something that you would give them?
Yeah, so this is what we've newly developed here at the University of Notre Dame, and we call it a lead screening kit. And what this kit allows people to do is to be proactive in collecting samples in their homes. So they get to collect dust samples, soil samples, and paint samples. And then they put them into a little kit, and it takes about 15 minutes. And we have tutorials online on how to do it. We've got really good instructions inside of the kit. And then they send it here to Notre Dame. And then we test it here in our laboratory. And within 2 weeks, they have an electronic report with the results in their inbox. And if anybody needs to have them mailed, we can also accommodate that as well.
When people get the information back, what does it tell them generally?
So it gives them a quantitative result for each of those samples. So right now what happens with lead testing, and it's pretty primitive, but you can go to one of the big box stores and you can get something that's called like the 3M lead check. And it allows you to test paint in a home to see whether or not it's lead based. The problem with that is that it's binary. It only lets you know about the absence or presence of lead. And what our kit does is it gives you a quantitative result. So you can understand the severity of the lead problem in your home. And that's across the board. That's for the sample, the paint, and the soil. So you get a quantitative result. And the way that we categorize those things so that it's easy to understand is we use the stoplight method so that, you know, you see red on your lab report and you know that that result exceeds the EPA recommendations, their guidelines. And so it tells a family, okay, I have red on my report. I need to respond immediately and do something. If I have yellow, that means that there's lead there, but it's moderate. It's intact, but you need to be monitoring what's going on. And then if it's green, it means that there wasn't any lead detected in that particular sample. In addition to getting that quantitative information, they also get DIY strategies about how to deal with what those results indicate, right? So if there were if there was lead in the soil, we provide recommendations on what to do about that. So for instance, that's covering it up with mulch or pea gravel or planting grass or planting shrubbery and that sort of thing. So we give them really practical solutions and strategies to deal with the problem at hand.
When it comes to lead paint, if somebody finds that they have significant amounts of lead in the paint, what is the solution for something like that?
Yeah. So, you know, this is where, you know, when we start getting in the weeds about lead, this is where it gets tricky, because it really is on a case by case basis. But generally speaking, if the paint condition is not bad, there is paint called encapsulation paint that is meant to neutralize the lead that exists in the paint. And it's very thick and very heavy. And my understanding is that that it can last for 10 years or more. So the first step we say to people is think about doing encapsulation paint and covering it up. Now, if you have a home that is significantly has a lot of lead in it, then you may need to go for full abatement, which means that you are going to interact with either a government agency or private companies who will come in and who will do that lead removal, much like the way we think about asbestos removal.
I'm assuming it's probably costly if you have to pay out of pocket to have a lead abatement.
Right. It is. It's very expensive. The good news is that there is actually much more federal dollars available now to support families who may have not enough resources to deal with that problem themselves. So, for instance, here in St. Joseph County, we have something like nearly $7 million from, I think we have three different grants, both state and federal grants, that are available here in our community. So families who are living in a home that is built before 1978 should absolutely be testing their home. That's job number one. Anybody living in a home before 1978, the reason we point to 1978 is because that was when Congress passed legislation to ban lead in paint. And so anybody who's got a home before 1978 should be testing their house for lead. If you identify lead in that house, then you should be, and you need additional resources to help you to fix your house, you should absolutely be reaching out to the city of South Bend for assistance.
The kits that you provide, how would somebody get one if they're listening right now and are interested in using one?
We have a website that is dedicated just to the lead screening kit, and it's actually called leadscreeningkit.com. And it's really simple to go on there. You fill out the form, couple pieces of information, and then I have a program manager, and she handles all the logistics of making sure that kits get out into the community and so forth.
And is this strictly for Indiana, or do you have people from around the country that are submitting stuff?
Right now, we are very focused on Indiana. So we have been working on this kit, developing this kit since 2017. And we published our findings in 2000. Forgive me, I'm not exactly remember what year. I think it was 2019. We published the results of our kit. And it showed great promise that when we compare the results from the kit as compared to the gold standard, which is called a lead risk assessment, we found that our kit was 96% accurate when compared to the gold standard.
Wow, so that's amazing.
It is amazing. It's really significant. And the reason, given those results, this is the reason that then HUD, who is a federal agency, awarded us a $700,000 grant to continue to scale the kit. So meaning, can you expand it to other communities and see similar results? And because HUD believes that we have something that is very promising. And so they're willing to invest in us. So this is why it's an exciting time, because we're developing something new. And honestly, in this space of lead, the new technologies are few and far between. The research actually in the lead space is actually quite old. This is a really, really promising new technology. And frankly, we're so grateful that, you know, you're spending time talking about this issue. We just want folks to know that if you live in a home before 1978, built before 1978, reach out and get a kit.
The kits you mentioned are 96% accurate at detecting lead levels. What does that compare to older kits?
Oh, say that again. Repeat the question.
The older kits that were out there, or the older ways to detect lead levels in the house, how did those compare in terms of accuracy versus what you're able to do?
Oh, okay. So we're talking about like these, the kits called the 3M lead check, and that is for paint only. So there aren't kits that exist that allow you to test your dust or your soil. So we're really on the cutting edge of something here. Nobody has packaged this concept so that you could collect a handful of samples and be able to find out more information about your home. That 3M lead check just tells you about the absence and presence of lead. So it doesn't have a comparable. You can't compare it to the gold standard because the gold standard gives you a quantitative result.
So I think most people often think when they think about lead, they think about paint. And so that's interesting that it's like dust and soil and that these are becoming more common knowledge.
That's right. And I'm so glad that you highlighted that. And that you are exactly right. People think that that the lead is only in the paint and that it really doesn't exist anywhere else. The truth of the matter is that over time, the paint in a home starts to deteriorate. Right? We have friction points in our houses. When windows go up and down or we open and close doors, those are friction points and it breaks down the paint and that paint turns into fine particulates and falls to the ground and then turns into dust just like everything else. And then where are our babies and toddlers playing? They're playing on the ground. You know, they're playing on the floor with their toys and so forth, and they're kicking up this dust and they're ingesting it. And we don't know it because you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it. And so we don't know that it's happening. So if I'm in a home and I'm looking around the room and all the paint is intact, right? All the surfaces are smooth. You're thinking to yourself, everything is fine here. But what we haven't taken into consideration are those friction points. And so that dust is being created on the inside of the house. Now, if we go to the outside of the house and there is lead paint on the outside of the house, over time, you know, all of the weather and elements break down the paint on the outside of the house. And so then where you see high levels of lead are usually around that drip line around the house. So that's about, you know, anywhere from 10 to 12 inches around the perimeter of the house. We call that the drip line. And then you'll find high levels of lead there. And if there's exposed soil, right, not covered up by mulch or maybe pea gravel or shrubbery and so forth, then kids can be playing in there. And then they bring that into the house. They might ingest some of the soil. They might lead might come loose from the soil and they ingest it through their nose. So this is why these other areas of lead exposure are really, really important.
Just to clarify, lead isn't something that's naturally out in the soil. Is it? It's something that's coming from paint and things that have it in it that are disintegrating into the earth.
Yeah, this is true, except to say that lead is naturally occurring. Right. So lead exists in our world. It's just that lead has these amazing properties. It's actually an incredibly useful element. The problem is that it's incredibly toxic and it adversely affects every single organ in our bodies. It goes everywhere. Lead is really, really similar to calcium. In that it has the same atomic weight and the same charge. And so, as we know, we often give calcium to children, right, as for growing and development. Well, what happens is when kids are lead poisoned, the lead, because it mimics calcium, it follows the calcium wherever it goes. So what do we know about calcium? We always say strong bones, strong teeth. Well, ultimately, that's where the lead ends up. In repositories in our teeth and in our bones.
Wow, so that's scary.
It is very scary. And this is and the thing is, you are so right that that the conventional wisdom is that most people just believe that lead is in paint. And if I don't see it and my paint isn't peeling, I'm fine. And it is so much more complex than that. And this is why it's so tough to educate and build awareness about it, because it's not a soundbite. It takes a few minutes to really understand what is happening with lead and lead in our community. I wanted to just say one more thing about the natural occurrence of lead. You know, lead, obviously, it's an element, so it's been around for millennia. But there are theories that lead actually brought down the Roman Empire. lead actually has a sweetness to it. And the Romans added lead to their wine, to sweeten their wine. And so the theory goes that people were ingesting so much lead that it led to the downfall of the Roman Empire.
Well, I'm never going to look at lead the same way.
I know. Same here. Believe me, when I learned all that, I couldn't believe what I was learning. Because I was just like everyone else. I knew lead was bad. I know lead it was in the paint. But beyond that, I didn't know much more than that.
I remember years ago, there was a big focus on lead in toys and or in products. Is that still the case?
Yeah, so we talk to moms and dads about that all the time. So toys that arrive from other countries may have lead in them. But then there's also all kinds of other things, spices, makeup, ceramic, pottery. These are all things coming in from other countries where that might not be regulating lead in those products. And then they show up here on our doorsteps and they can contain lead.
Those products having lead in them, is that something that the manufacturers, when they're making it, they're adding it in for some preservation reasons or is it just happening?
Yes. I don't know what all the properties are. So like, why would you think about adding lead to plastic? I'm mm-hmm. not familiar with that one as much. But I know in makeup, lead is really malleable and it helps makeup stay on longer. So I'm not kidding when I say lead has all these crazy useful properties, but there's this huge drawback that it is incredibly, incredibly toxic and has these long lasting damaging effects. And, you know, once you become significantly lead poisoned, you can't undo those things. And, you know, it leads to higher dropout rates and lower lifetime earnings and higher criminality. It's been associated, if you've higher lead poisoning is associated with higher incarceration rates. So it's devastating to society. I mean, if there's anything that we need to be focused on in public health, I'll tell you, this has got to be in the top three, is that we need to get rid of lead poisoning.
We have about a minute left. Is there anything you want listeners to take away?
Yes, for sure. Two things. One is the CDC recommends that every child should be tested at 12 and 24 months for lead. Go to your doctor, be an advocate for your child, and get your child tested at 12 and 24 months. Then, if you live in a home before 1978, reach out to us and get your house lead tested.
Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Heidi Beidinger, Director of the Master of Science and Global Health Program at the University of Notre Dame and co-founder of the Notre Dame Lead Innovation Team. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. You can always leave us a message at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.